Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope looks at Psalm 22. Pope Benedict says in times of trial, we must place our trust in God, as he continues his series of catechesi on prayer at the Wednesday General Audience. Touching hearts and minds. An English bishop talks about the impact of Pope Benedict's visit to Britain 1 year ago, and we also get feedback from a young person who attended the prayer vigil with the Pope in London's Hyde Park. And Exaltation of the Holy Cross. September the 14th is the feast day of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross, or the Triumph of the Cross. And we find out more about how and why this feast originated. Pope Benedict says in times of trial, we must place our trust in the God who brings salvation. He was speaking at his Wednesday General Audience, where he continued his series of teachings on Christian prayer. Charles Collins tells us more.
Today we reflect on Psalm 22, a heartfelt prayer of lamentation from one who feels abandoned by God.
It is one of the most familiar psalms and begins, my God, why have you forsaken me? The Pope said the psalm is a desperate appeal to God.
Surrounded by enemies who are persecuting him, the psalmist cries out by day and by night for help, and yet God seems to remain silent.
The Pope then spoke about the significance of the psalm for Christians.
In the Gospel of Matthew and Mark, the opening line of this psalm is placed on the lips of Jesus as he calls upon the Father from the cross. He too seems to have been abandoned to a cruel fate, while his enemies mock him, attacking him like ravenous and roaring lions, dividing his clothing among them as if he were already dead.
The Holy Father said, despite all appearances, the psalmist cannot believe that the relationship with the Lord has stopped completely. And after asking the reason for his apparent neglect, he says that his God cannot abandon him.
The psalmist recalls how in the past, the people of Israel called trustingly upon the Lord in times of trial, and he answered their prayer. He remembers the tenderness with which the Lord cared for him personally in his earlier life, as a child in his mother's womb, as an infant in his mother's arms, and yet now God seems strangely distant. Despite such adverse circumstances, so the psalmist's faith and trust in the Lord remains. The psalm ends on a note of confidence, as God's name is praised before all the nations. The shadow of the cross gives way to the bright hope of the resurrection. We too, when we call upon him in times of trial, must place our trust in the God who brings salvation. He conquers death with the gift of eternal life.
After the audience, the Holy Father returned by helicopter to the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo. I'm Charles Collins.
Your Holiness, I am delighted to welcome you to the United Kingdom, and particularly to Scotland, on your first visit as Pope.
Your Majesty, thank you for a gracious invitation to make an official visit to the United Kingdom and for your warm words of greeting on behalf of the British people. In thanking Your Majesty, allow me to extend my own greetings to all the people of the United Kingdom and hold out a hand of friendship to each one.
1 year ago this week, Pope Benedict was greeted by Queen Elizabeth at the start of his historic state visit to England and Scotland. A four-day visit that culminated with the beatification of the 19th century Cardinal John Henry Newman, a prominent Anglican churchman who converted to Catholicism. other key moments of the papal visit last September were a prayer vigil for young people in London's Hyde Park and the Pope's address to Britain's political movers and shakers in the Hall of Westminster. So how does the Church in Britain view the lasting impact of that historic papal visit 12 months later? A question I put to Bishop Kieran Connery of Arundel and Brighton in southern England, who's chair of the Department for Evangelisation and Catechesis.
I think Pope Benedict's visit last year greatly restored the confidence of many Catholics in this country. And I think it also significantly changed people's perception of the Catholic Church generally, because there was a degree of hostility in the media, certainly, before the Pope came. But as soon as Pope Benedict arrived, all that disappeared immediately. And the welcome he received, he spoke, allegedly, when he returned to Rome, as putting the wind back in his sails.
And what, for you, were some of the highlights, the most memorable moments of that visit as you saw it unfold?
I think one of the most astonishing moments was when Pope Benedict was allowed to address politicians, academics and others in Westminster Hall. That was quite unprecedented, that the Pope should have such a public platform to address the relations between, essentially between church and society, between church and state even, how the two could dialogue with one another helpfully. That was a very, very memorable moment, as well also as the vigil in Hyde Park in the centre of London, that the Pope is here in a public space in the centre of this country's capital. And the image of thousands and thousands of people, many of them young people, instinctively kneeling in silence before the Blessed Sacrament was a very, very moving sight.
Now, when you talk to your parishioners and the ordinary lay Catholics up and down the country in the months after that visit, what kind of feedback did you get? What kind of comments did they make about it?
They just felt better about being Catholic, that there had been a suspicion or a feeling that the church was being increasingly marginalised, that the voice of religion was being increasingly silenced. But I think the Pope's visit changed all that. The people felt confident about being Catholic. They felt they didn't have to defend themselves, didn't have to hide their Catholicity. And the Pope himself came across as warm, humble, and just a gentle man. One of the papers here said that from being the German Rottweiler, he became your favourite grandfather. It was a significant moment in the change of perception, both inside and outside the Catholic Church.
Now, how is this one-year anniversary being marked? I know it coincides with Home Mission Sunday. Tell us a bit about what you're doing.
The main thing we're doing is commemorating the visit, the departure of the Pope, with a national celebration in Westminster Cathedral in London. And we do expect that that cathedral will be filled on the day. I know that from our own diocese of Arundel and Brighton, we're sending over 300 people. And that will be a time, again, to rejoice as church, to say, well, we are here, we're not going away. And we're encouraging people to embrace, not just embrace the gospel personally, but to be more confident in announcing the gospel. It's wonderful to have the new translation of the Roman Missal here and to be able to say at the end of Mass to people, go and glorify the Lord by your life, or go and announce the gospel of the Lord. And that's what we're calling on people to do. First of all, to acquaint themselves more with the teaching of the church, to be catechized. It was interesting that at the end of World Youth Day in Madrid recently, Cardinal Rilke said to the young people, be better catechized than your parents. Because we have failed in many respects. We failed to catechize adequately a few generations. So we're asking people to learn about their faith. And then when they've learned it, or as they're learning it, to spread it and to communicate it, to share it.
But is it a concern that the increasing secularisation which you see all around you, is this something that you really have to increasingly find new ways of combating?
I don't think we do. It's interesting that both this Pope and the previous Pope spoke of the new evangelisation, but without being specific about what it involves, because there can't be a new gospel to preach, but there are new circumstances, a new context in which to preach. And I think we're perhaps sometimes exaggerating the levels of secularism. I think the greater threat is indifference, and rather than hostility, it's apathy. People simply haven't heard the gospel. They don't know about God. And we are a very consumerist, very materialistic society. And I think that's a bigger threat than what we call secularism, because we haven't really either identified what we mean precisely by secularism. It's not anti-religion, I don't think. But it's a world where people are searching for, certainly not a world, but our society in Western Europe, people are searching for happiness, but in ways which are transitory, they're trivial, they're superficial. And instead, we've got to say to people, true happiness will only be found in the true discovery of your humanity. And humanity is best expressed in the person of Jesus Christ.
The climax of that papal visit, of course, was the beatification mass for Cardinal John Henry Newman. What, for you, did the proclamation of this new blessed, how has this impacted on the church there?
It's funny that people, when they speak about the papal visit, they don't really talk about Newman. They talk about the Pope and the events. They talk about the celebration of the Mass in Birmingham at Coughton Park. They talk about Hyde Park. They talk about Twickenham. They talk about the places where the Pope met the people, and in Scotland too. So I don't think that Cardinal John Henry Newman has made that much of an impact. The biggest, by far the most enormous impact, was made by the person of Pope Benedict.
I was speaking to Bishop Kieran Connery of Arundel and Brighton in England.
This is an evening of joy, of immense spiritual joy for all of us. We are gathered here in prayerful vigil to prepare for tomorrow's Mass.
One of the hundreds of thousands of young Catholics who attended the prayer vigil presided over by the Pope in London's Hyde Park last September was 21-year-old Lucy Jenkinson, who's just graduated from university. She spoke to me about what this papal visit meant for her.
I would say that personally it's one of the first times I'd gathered together with a big group of young people who shared my faith, and people from all different backgrounds who had something in common. And that was a really positive experience for everyone involved, I think. We all got to hear about a lot of the good things that we'd all done with our parishes, with Catholic and different charities and organisations, and just with families that have been motivated to do either charitable work or just really positive things by their faith, which was really encouraging in this sort of day and age. And personally, I feel I left the event feeling that I'd sort of consolidated my faith somewhat, and it made me have a greater understanding of how sharing my beliefs can actually help to strengthen what I think. By sharing it with other people, it can help to really reinforce a belief that I hold on my own, and now know that I have the confidence to talk about with other people and to know that I'm not alone in what I feel and think, and some of the things that you have to reconcile as a young person in Britain today who's also a Catholic.
Now, of course, and on this occasion, you also got to see the Pope in person, albeit at a distance, along with lots of other people. But what impact did he as a figure have in some way? Did you have some kind of preconceptions that afterwards were changed? I mean, what kind of impact did he make on you as a person?
I think, if anything, seeing the Pope in person, as obvious as it might sound, make you realise that he is human and he is a person, and he would have had to battle with some of the same questions that you did perhaps, and that he's come such a long way from the point that you are in your life now, having graduated personally, and everything that he's achieved academically, socially and otherwise. And it was just amazing to see someone who you hear so much about in the flesh. Yeah, it was exciting in a way, and to know that he cares about young people and that he'd come to Britain to show a form of solidarity and to show that it was still important for him to keep rejuvenating the church through the young people and through every generation.
And you attended the prayer vigil in Hyde Park, and you were also there at Westminster Cathedral. What were some of the most memorable or moving moments of those events?
I think saying the Mass together was just a real experience. There were thousands of people there, all young people, and that was It was really, really special. Also, seeing all the media there was amazing. It felt like, oh my gosh, other people were interested in what we think and what we're doing. And that was a kind of a surprise, but a good surprise. Have to say that probably even after the Mass and after the vigil, having my friends ask me about it, people that I would never normally talk to about a religion at all or my beliefs, just things that don't come up in everyday conversation, and having the chance to challenge their misconceptions and prejudices about certain things that they believe to be true because they've not been involved in a religion at all themselves. And also on the day at the vigil, hearing some of the speakers was so moving. Some of the people that came and talked about how faith has impacted their life and helped them to get through hard times. And it was just really, really moving to hear these people that have really come through some difficult things and helped by their faith.
And how difficult do you find it is as a Catholic in a society where, you know, Catholicism is a minority faith in Britain and where it's a highly secularised and materialistic society? How difficult is it to maintain your faith and build on it?
It isn't easy. I'd be lying if I said that it was something that everyone accepted and something that everyone understood and was completely at ease with, because it isn't. They've heard a lot of negative things in the media, and if that's all you hear, then that's all you understand of it. Things like the Da Vinci Code brought it to the fore a little bit, and people think that they understand things that aren't true, etc. So it's difficult. You have to constantly reaffirm it yourself and think about the positive things that faith can motivate you to do, the confidence that it gives you, the sense of solidarity with other people in your community, the fact you can go anywhere in the country, you can go to visit friends at different universities in different countries even, and say a Mass together is an amazing thing, and you have to hold fast to all those positive things that are part of your faith, because it would be easy to just sort of give up on it in a sense, or to call yourself Catholic and not be active about it. So I think it's really important to carry on being proactive and carry on reminding yourself why it is important to you personally and the reasons that you have and your family have for being Catholic in the first place.
That was Lucy Jenkinson, a young Catholic from Epsom in England, talking about last year's papal visit to Britain. September the 14th is the feast day of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross, or the Triumph of the Cross. Like many other liturgical feasts, this feast had its origin in Jerusalem and is linked with the commemoration of the finding of the wood of Christ's cross. It's an important feast, especially for Eastern Christians, whether Catholic or Orthodox. In some parts of the world, the liturgy is often accompanied by a procession, in which a large cross or crucifix is taken out of the door of the church, and the congregation walks around the church, stopping at various points to offer prayers and to sing hymns. But exactly when and why did the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross come into existence, and what is its meaning? To find out more, I spoke to Father Joseph Kramer, a parish priest based in Rome of the Priestly Fraternity of St. Peter.
Well, the feast is a bit of a double-decker feast in that it celebrates two things: the restoration of Christ's cross to the city of Jerusalem in the early 7th century, when the emperor Heraclius defeats the Persians, defeats Chrysero, who in 615 had captured Jerusalem and taken off as a trophy to Persia the cross, the true cross. In 629, Heraclius, the emperor of the West, defeats the Persians and insists on the restoration of the true cross. And the Persians give it back, and Heraclius takes the true cross back to Jerusalem, and it's erected again in the Martyrion, or the Basilica of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem. The day selected to celebrate the restoration and re-erection of this cross and the placing of this relic in the Martyrion in Jerusalem was chosen, the date chosen was the 14th of September.
Why was that?
Because 14th of September was the date of the dedication of this basilica in 335 by the Emperor Constantine. The tradition is that Constantine's mother Helena had discovered the true cross in Jerusalem.
During excavations.
Because if we remember that Constantine in 313 issues the edict freeing the practice of Christianity in the Roman Empire, and here in Rome he builds the Basilica of St. Peter's over the tomb of St. Peter in 325, and there's a dedication of that basilica. 10 years later, he dedicates the Martyrion, or the Basilica of the Resurrection and of Calvary, the two basilicas set next to each other and connected, on the sites of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection.
Do we know when the feast day sort of moved from Jerusalem and went to Rome and then from there elsewhere around the world?
Yes, in the 8th century, and if not before. And in the West, we have 2 days to celebrate these two things. We have a day to celebrate Helen's finding of the true cross, and then we have this day, the 14th of September, to celebrate the restoration of the true cross to its rightful place in Jerusalem by the Emperor Heraclius.
Can you tell us a little bit then about the meaning and the importance of this feast?
Well, obviously, very important because Christ redeems us by his cross. And St. Paul already talks about how the cross, as an instrument, is a means of our salvation. Obviously, it's what Christ does on the cross that really saves us. But the cross becomes a symbol of Christ's suffering, death, and resurrection, his triumph over death. So it's natural that there was a great interest in finding the actual cross on which our Savior died. This wasn't really possible until the promulgation of Christianity by the Emperor Constantine. And one of the first things Constantine does, really, is make sure that in Jerusalem, the site of the crucifixion and the resurrection are venerated. And to do this, he builds a cathedral. That they should find the cross is not that surprising because...
Why is that?
In the ancient world, the instruments of execution were buried with the executed person, I mean, with the person executed, especially in the Jewish world, because the cross beam of the cross would have been stained with the blood of Christ. And in the burial, anything touched by the blood or saturated by the blood was buried together with the body in the same tomb.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the liturgical ceremony of the exaltation of the cross. Are there any particular features that you'd like to bring to the attention of our listeners?
Yes, it's very interesting because it's rather like a autumn version of Easter, because as we know, Easter happens in the spring, and now we're just approaching the third of the quattro tempora, that the year is divided according to the movement of the sun. And in September, we get to the stage where the days are getting shorter and we're going towards the shortest day again.
At least in the Northern Hemisphere.
Well, yes, I mean, talking of the liturgy, I mean, I'm from Australia and it's a bit of a disaster down in Australia because everything's back to front. But the liturgy evolves here in the Northern Hemisphere. Anyway, this feast day is seen as a autumn Easter. And the next week, in fact, we'll have the Ember Days of September, which are penitential days. The feast day itself includes elements from the Easter feasts. Now, the reading from St. Paul is the same. Then in the West, we have, following on pretty closely, the feast day of Our Lady of the Seven Sorrows. And in the East, in the Greek Orthodox Church, where this feast day of the 14th of September
is also celebrated,
is also celebrated. It is celebrated in the East as the finding of the Holy Cross, which is really the original feast, even for us. The interesting thing is that the Transfiguration is put 40 days before the 14th of September. And that's how we have that August feast of the Transfiguration, both in the Eastern Church and in the Western Church.
Father,
Father Cremer is priest of a personal parish in Rome called Trinità dei Pellegrini that celebrates Mass according to the traditional Latin rite. It was, in fact, exactly 4 years ago that Pope Benedict's motu proprio document was implemented that relaxed the restrictions on celebrating the old rite of the Mass that was in use prior to the reforms that came out of the Second Vatican Council. I began by asking Father Cremer whether the old form of the Latin Mass has grown in popularity over the past 4 years.
Yes, it certainly has, especially in the United States, but not only. It's a slow growth, and the Holy Father points out himself in the motu proprio that the old rite requires quite a high level of liturgical formation, and a lot of Catholics just don't have that. They don't have much Latin anymore, and this also applies for the priests. So it's a work of rebuilding, really.
How many people on average attend the Sunday Mass at your church in Rome?
Oh, about 300.
And are there many other churches in Rome that celebrate the traditional Latin Mass?
Yes, there are a few churches that are doing less official celebration, and they have rather small congregations, but then again, rather steady congregations as well.
And is it all age groups who attend, or is it mostly...
Yes, well, the surprising thing is that it's mostly young people. Young people very drawn to the old Mass. Mm. They seem to like the order, the sacredness of it, the silence, the reverence. I think they're in reaction to my generation that broke with things in the 60s and like to think of themselves as innovative and modern. The young ones are quite different. They want to return to the traditional, the more stable.
The numbers, though, you know, worldwide are quite small, obviously, compared to the number who attend the post-Vatican II Mass. Do you believe it's always likely to remain as a small minority, yet a minority, of course, within the Church?
Yes, well, absolutely, yes, because, as I was saying before, to follow the old Mass, you need to, as I say, know Latin and know something about the liturgy, know how to follow the Mass, which is not so easy, really, because you, even if you're following with a missal, a bilingual missal in Latin and English, you have to know how to move from the proper of the Mass to the ordinary of the Mass.
And what feedback do you get, though, from the faithful? What, any particular marks that they make that explain why they like it and why they keep coming?
They keep coming because they find greater sacredness. And they like the silence, because in the old Mass, the canon is said silently at the altar. They like the pauses for reflection and prayer. They like the fact that the priest talks less. They like the fact that the priest isn't the main star in the celebration, and that the fact that he isn't facing them, and that everybody's turned towards the altar and towards God.
I was speaking to Father Joseph Cremer, an Australian parish priest based in Rome. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.